birds singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbirds singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You are only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird fly, blackbird fly, into the light of a dark black night.
Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices. Welcome on this wonderful Friday morning. Dr. Albert Schweitzer said, until he extends the circle of his compassion to all living things, man himself will not find peace. And Dick Gregory, the civil rights activist, said, Martin Luther King taught us all nonviolence. I was told to extend nonviolence to the mother and her calf. Yes, you're listening to Animal Voices, coming to you on CFRO Radio, 102.7 FM in Vancouver, affectionately known as Co-op Radio, coopradio.org. And we can, many of our programs you can listen to on animalvoices.org. So, your community-based and community-sponsored radio station. John Pranger is our technician, a longtime supporter of the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society that's opposed to animal experimentations as a scientific method. And in the studio today, we have Marge Adams. Good morning, Marge.
And, good morning, Carl.
Oh, it's almost afternoon, and you're on the board of the Vancouver Humane Society, and what are you going to be doing today?
I'm going to be talking to one of the very interesting employees of the Vancouver Humane Society. His name is Bruce Passmore, and Bruce is the Farm Animal Welfare Project Coordinator. Always interesting to talk with Bruce. He'll be telling us about his Chicken Out project.
Thank you, Marge. And also, we have an in-studio guest today, and it's... Kelly Harris. Welcome, Kelly Harris, to Animal Voices, and what will you be doing today?
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to be talking with you, Carl, about my entrance into the animal activist community, started by a book that I read called The Omnivore's Dilemma, which is full of some amazing facts that I'm very looking forward to sharing with your listeners.
Yes, shortly we'll be speaking with Kelly Harris. And just some news from People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA.org, PETA.org. And they're on a very good Christmas program because, especially back east, many dogs are left outside. And they wrote this, 496 dogs can look forward to a shelter in sturdy dog houses through the frigid winter months this year and for many years to come. There are so many dogs facing cold while they are chained in freezing backyards with only the most decrepit shelter, if any. For the past 9 winters, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA, PETA.org, has driven around into low-income, depressed areas and provided hundreds of durable, solid dog houses free of charge to dogs who otherwise would have had to endure the bitter cold, wind, ice, and snow without any shelter or with just a piece of metal or board up against the fence. Each doghouse is built to last and filled with straw bedding to help provide what for some dogs is the first feeling of warmth and comfort they've ever known. And that's just another reason why to go and have a look at the PETA webpage, and also, if you can, to support them, PETA.org. Well, we have Kerry Harris in the studio today, and she's been reading, and she's undergoing a change of life here, or change of friends, too, because she is in the beginner stages of being an animal activist. And welcome to the clan, you know.
Tell it's us, great to be here.
What was the motivating incentive?
Well, I think the biggest motivating incentive was that I adopted a dog, and I've had dogs growing up. It's the first dog I've had as an adult, and I'm in my 30s. And I adopted this dog, and she was from a puppy mill. And it gave me so much pleasure to, you know, get this dog some vet care and some good food and, you know, let her sleep on my bed and all the comfort and luxury she's ever enjoyed. And I just started thinking about the other animals in the world who are in the same kind of confinement that my dog endured at the puppy mill, and specifically cows and pigs and chickens and animals we raise for food. And I walked into a bookstore one day and saw this book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, and opened it right up to a page about the ethics of eating animals. And I thought, this is exactly what I've been looking for. So I read the book cover to cover, and it just, you know, I've read Fast Food Nation, I've read Diet for New America years ago, but this book, more than anything, really was the tipping point. And haven't had dairy since, still, you know, buying organic eggs, and only free range beef and dairy products if I buy them, chicken too. So
one of the glories of the book is what Michael Pollan writes about his attitude towards the issues that you've become involved in. And he says, I'm interested in food because food connects to everything.
Mm-hmm.
We're defined by what we eat, not just biologically, but culturally. It's a doorway to so many other aspects of life. It seems like a narrow door, but you pass through it and you can go anywhere.
That is so true, and that is exactly what this book is about. It's the origin of food, not just the animal products, but he delves into the origin of a lot of the processed foods that we have, which are largely in existence because of corn syrup, corn oil, high fructose corn syrup, and how much a component commodity corn is in our food system, and just the origin of food. And I had never really thought about where our food comes from, and definitely after reading the book, walking into Safeway, things look very different.
So what's happening on the cornfields? I mean, where does most of the corn end up?
Well, a lot of the corn, like the thing, corn is just so becoming the major agricultural product in our country, and more so in the United States, but definitely also in Canada. And the government subsidizes the growth of corn, so what it's giving farmers a lot of incentive to stop growing a variety of crops and just concentrate on corn. And they've got fertilizer, which makes the corn grow like crazy, and there's a guaranteed price for the corn. So even if there's a surplus of corn, the farmers still get a guaranteed price because the government's subsidizing it. So we've got tons of corn, just, you know, millions and millions of tons of excess corn, and there's nowhere to put it. So they're, you know, channeling it into high fructose corn syrup, which is replacing cane sugar as the number one sweetener, if it hasn't already. And we've started feeding it to animals.
Well, I thought that a large percentage of all this corn that's grown in the United States is fed to chickens.
Chickens too, yes, and cows as well. Cows eat the corn, and cows are not born to eat corn. They're grass eaters, so we're giving them a grain when they are biologically made to digest grass. And yes, the chickens eat it as well, and pigs, and basically all the animals we grow for agricultural needs are largely being fed a corn-based diet.
Now, he has some graphic examples of how much corn it takes to make one pack of corn chips and something. Have you got any?
Yeah, I know. I don't have the statistics
there
off the top of my head, but
right.
what really struck me about the corn is just, yeah, how hugely inefficient it is. Because, you know, the author spends time, and the best part of the book by far is when he spends time on a farm called Polyface Farm in Virginia. And you can go on their website, and it's a very famous farm. They basically don't use fertilizer, they don't produce any waste. All the animals are free to express their animal instincts. And he compares, you know, basically feeding a cow grass, which is grown by the sun for free, versus growing corn with fertilizer and petroleum products and feeding it to cows who aren't meant to eat corn, so we have to give them all kinds of drugs and antibiotics and special enzymes to help them, and they get all bloated and sick. And basically, we're slaughtering cows a lot earlier than we used to. Cows have a lifespan of, 25 years, and we slaughter them by the age of 5, sometimes even younger. And they're, like Michael Pollan points out in the book, that the way we feed and keep these animals, they wouldn't last much longer than the 15 months or the few years that we keep them alive, because we're feeding them the wrong food. They're sick. They're full of antibiotics and hormones. And we're essentially, what horrified me after reading this book is the food, the meat that we buy in the supermarkets is largely diseased from sick, mistreated animals. And I just can't be a part of that anymore, as I know you can't either. So
now you expressed some strong feelings about the that we should not be feeding these animals grains, corn, mm-hmm. and soy, because mm-hmm. most of the soy that is grown in North America is also fed to cows.
You're right, yes.
And so what's it doing to them?
Well,
is E. coli and
yeah,
stuff?
That was a very interesting discovery, and that I was quite horrified to read, which is that cows are meant to. They're grass eaters, right? And so grass causes a neutral pH in the stomach of the cows. So what happens is, if there's any E. coli present in the cow once it's slaughtered, when we humans consume it, because our stomach is an acid environment, we will kill the E. coli. So we have a natural defense against E. coli, because the E. coli is a strain of E. coli that lives in the cow's neutral stomach. Now, because we're feeding corn to cows, and Michael Pollan goes into great detail about this, because we're feeding corn to the cows, we're causing an acid environment in the stomach of the cows. So we're basically breeding strains of E. coli that can survive in an acid environment. They're surviving in the acid stomach of the cows. And so when we consume it, if there's any E. coli in that meat, we don't have any defense, because this E. coli can survive in our acid stomach. So it just started to get this ominous, feeling reading it, that maybe that's what's going to have to happen in our meat system, for everyone to kind of wake up and say, wait a minute, we don't want to be raising animals this way, because it's going to make us sick. Now, the interesting thing is, they've done studies, because it's a huge problem, the E. coli possibility of an E. coli epidemic. And they've done studies where if you take a cow off the corn-based diet and feed it grass for 3 days before it's slaughtered, just the 3 days is enough to turn the acid environment of the cow's stomach into neutral. And therefore, eliminate a lot of the E. coli that would then be transferred to us. But
that's,
they don't do it.
Absolutely,
it's
amazing.
It's amazing. I was shocked. I said, you mean this information is out here? They presented it to all these, feedlots, and they said, well, it's just not cost-effective for us to take all these cows and put them on grass. And the truth is, it isn't.
Which raises the other issue, is that this feeding grains, as you're saying, is less cost-effective than feeding them grass?
Yeah, and it is exactly. It all comes down to price.
Grass grows wild in the fields.
Mm-hmm. But we need so much land to produce, the meat that comes from cows. And what Michael Pollan also talked about, which I really liked, was basically that the meat we eat and the dairy products and the eggs, they're all kind of artificially low-priced. And what keeps a lot of people from buying free-range beef, for example, is that it's, 2, 3, sometimes 4 times as expensive as the meat we can buy from feedlots. But it's an artificially low price, because we're paying for it in, government subsidies to the farmers, and, the artificially low cost of the corn that we're feeding them, the horrible conditions these animals are enduring. Basically, it's not possible to produce meat ethically for the prices we're paying now. And that's the dilemma, right? It's like, how if we want to stop mistreating animals, the price of meat is going to go up, and there's going to be a huge market resistance to that.
Now, a year ago, of course, the production of food is highly petroleum-based.
Definitely.
Intensive. A year ago, the price per barrel of oil was like $55. It's now $90. Surely that's going to have an exponential effect on farmers who are producing this unnatural energy source.
Yes, and very dependent on oil energy, these farmers now are. My father, I've turned him on to this book, and he's doing some work right now. He's a doctor, and he's working in rural Alberta and speaking to a lot of farmers, and a lot of them are complaining exactly what you're talking about, that the rising cost of feed and transporting their animals is making it basically impossible for them to continue raising their livestock. So what's happening is everything's becoming consolidated, right? And now all these little pig farms are becoming one pig farm and all being transported to one big slaughterhouse way far away. Like, everything's just getting bigger and more consolidated, and the animals are the ones suffering. But it's all to keep the price down, you know?
It'll keep the price down, but and they can only economize to such a degree, but the costs will rise and many of them will go bankrupt.
Definitely. And we're going to lose all our farms.
Or alternatively, wouldn't the price of the product increase? So it would become less affordable. And somebody, like I was at the grocery store this morning. The lady in front of me was just buying vegetables and fruit. My God, she bought, they filled three bags of fruit and vegetable. And the girl said, $15.25, please. And you know,
no, it's amazing.
You get so much food, and it's basically fairly good stuff.
It definitely is. It definitely is. Michael Pollan talks also in the book about how, you know, in the 1950s, meat was a luxury. You know, like they had a roast once a week, and that's kind of what we need to go back to for our health, and definitely for the health of the planet and for the well-being of the animals. He talks about, too, like, you know, we're all really keen on saving the environment and reducing our carbon footprint. You can reduce your carbon footprint by stopping eating meat, or at least decreasing it significantly, more so than even losing your car.
Now, we know there's different, there's cattle that they raise on feedlots. You've been talking about it. But also dairy cows. Now, I happen to know that the average dairy cow in Canada, as you said, I'd just like to repeat it because it's so important, the average cow should live between 20 and 25 years. The statistics show that the average dairy cow, after 2.3 lactations, is considered to be what they call a spent dairy cow. They become so vulnerable to diseases because 75% of all dairy cows in Canada never leave the concrete, never ever grow out on a field. Yeah. So they live approximately 3-4 years, and then
hamburger meat because the meat is so poor it can't be eaten. Steak, we don't consume it. It becomes animal feed usually.
But they're producing milk.
Yes, they're producing
milk.
You know, the milk thing is very interesting because I was a vegetarian for a couple of years, but I always, you know, ate milk and dairy ate dairy and eggs and didn't think anything of it. But after reading The Omnivore's Dilemma, there's information definitely about the dairy cows in there, and it prompted me to go on the internet and find out more. And I actually didn't know. I was saying this to you earlier, Carl. I didn't realize that the cows, for them to produce milk, they need to be pregnant or just have given birth to a cow. And it just never occurred to me. And I can't believe I never thought of this, because obviously that's how any animal would lactate, is if they're, you know, pregnant or just having delivered a baby. But what they do is they keep these cows pregnant every single year. So they're artificially inseminated every year. And veal, like I've never eaten veal. And I'm very quite proud of that because I always knew it was a bad thing. But if I'm drinking milk, I'm contributing to the production of veal, because anytime a dairy cow gives birth to a baby cow who's a male, it becomes veal. And what was the expression you said? There's
the pound. Bruce Frederick from PETA, said there's a chunk of veal in every glass of milk.
Oh, and I just love that expression. It's so graphic and memorable. And the thing about the dairy cows too, you're right, they get very spent. And the other thing that I found quite horrible is that the dairy cows often get mastitis, which, you know, because they're constantly hooked up to these milking machines, and they're given so much growth hormones, their udders become very distended, they're dying to be milked, they're in a lot of pain, and even though they're infected with mastitis, they still keep them pregnant, keep them producing milk. And the dairy industry, I read something like they allow a small percentage of the pus that comes from the infected udders to enter the milk stream. And they say, oh yeah, but it's okay because we pasteurize the milk. But I was so repulsed by the idea that there's this, you know, these infected bacteria in our milk. Even if it's pasteurized, I don't want to have anything to do with it. So I started buying Rice Dream to put on my cereal. And the first 2 days, I admit, it wasn't as good as milk, but now I'm confirmed. I'm not going back.
Yeah, and another thing that entered my mind when you were talking about the use of corn so extensively in producing animal products to be eaten is that they're talking about using corn for fuel. Now, that is going to make some have some impact, isn't it, on the feed for animals? What is likely to happen there, I wonder?
You know, I've been talking to my father about this again. He's talking to these farmers about these corn farmers out in Alberta about this promised, you know, ethanol market. But apparently there haven't been any ethanol factories made yet, and, you know, they're still producing tons of corn. But producing ethanol from corn, it's got to be the most inefficient way to get fuel. We've just got to get away from cars is what we have to do. But, yeah, we're using petroleum to grow the corn. We're using petroleum to turn the corn into ethanol. We're using petroleum to transport the corn to the ethanol factories. You know, it's completely
illogical.
It's completely illogical, and it's all because we need our cars.
Well, and we're transporting the animals, too.
Definitely.
It's so cruel. But we'll come into that later. John, the other question, you're going through a transformation here, which is really quite fascinating for us.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we've been doing this program for 8 years now.
Wow.
And some of the statistics, you know, they're actually staying in my brain here. So, but what was, to me, giving up some of the dairy products was quite difficult. Mm-hmm. How are you, how's it going with you?
Well, it's going really well. You know what I find? I think anyone who starts eating more healthily, you realize you don't need as much food as we consume. That's been my number one discovery. It's like, I don't actually need the quantity of food that I've always been eating. For some reason, I'm sure a person who's a homeopathic nutritionist can tell me how that works. But I've been doing fine. But let me tell you something interesting. I stopped drinking alcohol 6 months ago, and I was so worried that my friends would, you know, give me heck for that. And let me tell you, moving towards vegetarianism has given me a lot more socially negative feedback. You know, people saying, oh, don't become a vegetarian. Oh, vegetarians are such a drag at dinner parties. They can't eat anything. And, you know, they're always imposing their views on you. And, like, I can't believe it. I'm actually sometimes more shy to say I'm leaning towards vegetarianism than that I don't drink.
One of my friends who is a vegetarian solves that problem quite easily. She also has health problems, but she'll always say, okay, that's fine, I'd love to come, I'll bring a dish.
Yeah.
And so she said, that assures me that I have something to eat. And because it does make other people uncomfortable if you're kind of picking a little here and, you know, and so on, but bring a dish.
Plus, there's such a variety of foods that even grow in our area here that we discovered.
Yeah.
The other day, I was walking past in New Westminster and came across a persimmon tree with over 100 persimmons in it.
Wow.
Just the kind that you pay 99 cents each for. And it was quite a wonderful sight that they grow here. What we're going to do is maybe just mention the book.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
We're talking with Kelly Harris.
And I'm The Omnivore's Dilemma. I highly recommend it. It's a joy to read. It's beautifully written. It's one of the New York Times best books of the year, and it's a fantastic work of nonfiction. It's one of those books, you know, you read a phrase and it's so beautifully composed, you want to read it again. It's wonderful, and it's life changing in many ways.
And what Omnivore's Dilemma, the book Michael Pollan writes, he says, was written about the book. It says, it gives people the tools they need to make good decisions as citizens or consumers.
Definitely.
Depending on what your values are, the environment, your health, animal welfare, the answers are going to be different for every person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're going to be back to you towards the end of the program.
Great, thank you.
So you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. Our webpage is animalvoices.org. Many of our programs are listed on our webpage, animalvoices.org. And now over to Marge Adams.
Thank you, Carl. Now we have Bruce Passmore of the Vancouver Humane Society on the line, and his job has been a Farm Animal Welfare Project Coordinator. Welcome to Animal Voices, Bruce.
Thanks, Mart. I'm happy to be back.
Well, yes, and it's been quite a while. We're always happy to have you on the show. Now, you've been working with the Vancouver Humane Society for the last 4 years, and for much of that time, your focus, your main focus, has been the Chicken Out Project. which I think has been tremendously successful. So I want to have you tell us about that, and we'll discuss some salient points. Now, would you mind starting by giving us the outline of the major objectives of the project?
Sure. The Chicken Out Project was started in 2002, as you know, and many of your listeners have been following along. And the main focus of it is really to get hens out of cages, to reduce animal suffering. And we're talking 26 million egg-laying hens in Canada. So that's a lot of animals that need our help, all of our help. So what the project's aim to do is to try and reduce people's consumption and use of eggs from caged hens. It's a fairly simple initiative, really, when you look at it. And, you know, it's one of those types of activities that most people can get on board with. You know, it's not asking for a huge, dramatic life change for them. It's just asking them to help us get hens out of cages and stop using eggs from caged hens. Really simple.
Now, when you started this project, started working on this project, because I think it was going perhaps a little bit before you joined the society, but the public knew virtually nothing about caged hens, and they weren't particularly interested in knowing anything either.
That's right. You know, when we first started this project, that's one of the reasons why we jumped on it, was because in Canada, at that time, nobody was really talking about caged hens. Nobody was really talking about farm animals in that to that degree. And I shouldn't say nobody was. Lots of people were talking about it, just very few people were listening. And so we wanted to focus on a project that we could make a really big difference and really sort of champion this project. And I think that's the key thing, Marge, is that the idea of focusing. It's so difficult. We look at all these different issues out there, and we think, my gosh, you know, we've got pigs in sow stalls, we've got, you know, foie gras, we've got all these issues going on. And it just, we had to put some of that aside a little bit and really focus on this one issue. And that's where I think has made the difference. And that's why I think we're starting to see some results.
Yeah, otherwise you can become totally overwhelmed, can't you, and kind of depressed about the situation with animals.
Absolutely. You know, and it's not to say that we don't care about those other issues and we won't do things when we can. We absolutely will, because there are so many issues to be working on. I think all of us who are passionate know that feeling. But what's made the difference really is to pick this one issue and just follow it right through to the end, do that long-term commitment, and keep going with it. And I think it's working. We're really seeing
you
some
bet
great,
it's working.
Great changes.
Now, tell us, how did you get the, you know, what did you do in order to get this interest that is certainly out there?
What we've really been trying to do in this last year is build empathy. We started off with trying to show the most shocking images and really trying to sort of, I guess, almost guilt people into making changes. And we decided, let's try a different approach. Let's try building empathy. Let's try showing people how interesting these creatures are, and work, I guess, more on a personal level, work on an emotional level for the individual. So showing them that, you know, we can be kind, so let's be kind.
Mm-hmm. Then did you notice the interest developing very quickly, or was it a long haul?
It has been a long haul, but, you know, I have to say, I think this year we hit a tipping point. I think actually the whole global warming and green issue and the inconvenient truth and all those things has actually played a really positive role in animal issues, because what it's done is it's made people a bit more aware about how their actions impact the world around them. Now, sure, a lot of people are thinking about using compact fluorescent light bulbs and you know, driving less and all these different things, but I think people are also starting to see, well, you know, that wasn't so challenging, so how difficult is it for me to reduce my animal consumption or to reduce my, you know, use of products that are tested on animals? And, you know, starting off with these little tiny steps, and then, you know, once that door opens, once people start saying, well, I'm reducing it for this reason, why don't I just eliminate it? And we're starting to see that happening, and I really think that we have hit a bit of a tipping point, and I think 2008 is going to be even bigger.
Yeah, it certainly feels like there's a momentum going now. Now, tell us about some of the indicators, will you, of how effective this campaign has been.
Well, I think what we can look at is what's happened sort of in the university and corporate sector here in Canada. Up until at this time last year, we didn't have a single major company looking at changing at that particular point. But suddenly, in this last year, we've moved that so much further. We have universities and colleges and schools from coast to coast dropping eggs from caged hens or severely reducing their use of eggs from caged hens en route to getting rid of them entirely. We've got corporations on board. We've got huge corporations that are looking at their options and how they can do it. It's an enormous change, and the number of animals that this is affecting is just phenomenal, and this is what I think makes us all feel so good about it. And, you know, what I have to say is it's all of us doing this. It's not just the Vancouver Humane Society. I mean, we've done a lot of work on this, but it's our supporters, it's our donors, it's you, it's people on the radio. It's everybody. We're all working together because we're not letting this issue go away.
Has this had an effect in other provinces as well, or do you have any way of knowing that? Because I know it's had a terrific effect right here.
Absolutely. We've actually, one of the things we did with the project is we decided to use BC as a model, because we did have some of the bigger changes happen right here with Langara College and BCIT, UBC, and a number of other smaller locations. We took that model and we pushed it across the country, and we've now got schools in Quebec and Ontario, and hopefully some more to pop up throughout the other provinces. So some really big changes happening. That was some of the things, because we were focusing on just a single issue with this project. We were just focusing on eggs from caged hens. We were able to broaden that model to locations rather than different issues, and I think that's helped with our success as well. It's also made us more credible on the national level, which has been really, really helpful for us getting meetings with large corporations.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And who are some of the local organizations? And there's a lot of big names involved, not just corner stores.
Absolutely. One of the larger corporations that does have offices here as well is Chartwell's, believe it or not. They're one of the largest food service organizations. They're part of Compass Group Canada. And they're making some really positive changes. In fact, they're leading the way here in BC as far as food services. They hold the food service contracts at a lot of universities and colleges. And they've really shown a sincere commitment. They are the ones who are behind the BCIT and Langara College, and they'll be behind a lot more that we hope to see in the near future. So that's one of the larger companies, and then there's lots of other companies that are discussing it, and I probably shouldn't name them because they're just looking into it right now.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to count the chickens before they hatch, so to speak.
Simon Fraser, though, hasn't it?
Simon Fraser is one of the places that's looking into it, and we hope to see some good news coming out of there in the very, very beginning of the new year, if not just in January itself. So those are some of the really good changes happening, and we will see so much more, I think, in 2008, because this issue is gaining so much momentum, and we get calls every single day from companies, from students at universities saying, how can I make this happen? I understand the issue. What can I do? And that's the interesting thing. When we go into these meetings and we talk to different people, it's no longer, what are you talking about? It's like, okay, I understand the issue. Now what can I do to make a difference? And that's really encouraging. That shows that consumers and the public have come so far from where they were a few years ago.
Have you had any response at all from the producers, the egg producers?
Interestingly enough, we have, and what we're hearing from them is just that they're switching. They're rushing to try and switch their operations over. It's a slow process, but
yeah.
One of the things that's interesting in the way the egg marketing system works, being a quota system, they have to switch. They can't just add. So it's quite an interesting process, and we're seeing more hens not in cages. And one of the interesting things is cage-free operations tend to have fewer hens, so we'll see a lot more of a reduction in the number of hens overall in agriculture, which is the case what's happened in Europe when all the countries that went cage-free also had a huge reduction in the number of hens just in general in agriculture. So that's another really positive spin-off of it. And that's, of course, this isn't the end of the story. This, you know, there are problems with every single system, but this is a really big step in towards reducing animal suffering in this world.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I wonder about the product, you say there are fewer hens when they convert to the non-caged hens. Is it possible to supply the stores with the certified organic or free-range eggs?
That's a really good question, Marge. And, you know, the truth is that if we were to switch everything over to a cage-free system, no, we wouldn't be able to keep the current consumption levels. We would not be able to meet the public's current demand. And that's for us is not a justification for animal cruelty. I think most people out there would agree that we're going to have to make some other changes. We are going to have to reduce our consumption, but that's not only going to be for eggs. That's going to be for everything. And we all know that on a global level, on an environmental, on a social, and on a personal level, we've got to make some reductions, either reduce or eliminate. But in the short term, we do have to convince people to try and reduce. And I think that's a palatable thing for a lot of people. You know, a lot of people have a hard time with the idea of eliminating things. So if we can at least get people to reduce, that's a huge, huge step. And you know what? I often sort of think about it. If we, each of one of us, could get seven people to have one day a week where they eat no animal products, that would be equivalent to getting one person to stop using animal products forever. And I think, you know, that's a big jump for some people, but one day, most people can handle that.
Absolutely.
So I think if we could get most people to that one stage, I think we would be moving so much further ahead. And it's a practical, real thing that each one of us can do. And, you know, you get seven people, and each one of those seven people will probably get one more of their friends, and it's just going to become an exponential growth.
That's a wonderful idea. It's something that would maybe not be too hard to sell on the public.
I hope not. And with the movement towards, you know, going green and making things easy for people, that's one way to do it. And it may not be quite as far as we would all love to see, but, you know, we've got to be practical and we've got to look at things in the immediate term. If we can reduce the suffering immediately while we work towards a bigger goal, then I think we're succeeding.
And so people who do eat eggs, will you remind them of what they should look for on the egg carton?
Absolutely. If you're consuming eggs, if you're buying eggs, go for certified organic, because there's absolutely no question they have the highest welfare standards of any commercially available egg. The hens are guaranteed to be free range, weather permitting, so they could be free run, but they'll have access to nests, perches, they'll have spaces to dust bathe, they'll have more space than any other system, so it's definitely something to look for. The next other options, if you can't find certified organic or for other reasons, you can take a look at free range and free run. The only catch is that there's nobody certifying those, except for there is an SPCA certified version of free range and free run, which does have higher standards and is audited. But the long and the short of it, certified organic's the way to go. If you can't, then free range and free run. But don't be confused by labels such as omega-3 or born-3, because they are just from hens in cages, and they are from the most cruel and inhumane system available.
Good to know. Now, I want to go on and talk about you. right now, will you give us the website so people can look up more information about this campaign?
Absolutely. www.chickenout.ca is where you'll find everything there is to know about egg-laying hens. And if you need a bit more information on other issues, take a look at vancouverhumanesociety.bc.ca. There's lots of information on there about not only the chicken issue, but other things that you can do and other issues that are going on, from animals and entertainment to exotic animals to domestic animals. There's animals on our website right now that are desperately in need of medical attention. And so, of course, a shameless plug, but if you have a few dollars to spare, we could always use it for the animals that are on our website. There's some very sad stories, but we're doing our best to try and help them. So take a look at our website.
Good. Thank you for that. Now, I've got some unhappy news to report, and that's that you will only be with the Vancouver Humane Society for almost 8 weeks. And at the end of January, you'll be launching into a new adventure, or many new adventures.
That's right.
How about telling us about your future plan?
Well, I have to say it was one of the most difficult decisions of my life to actually decide to step away from the Humane Society and go on to another adventure. And, you know, working with an organization like this that's achieved so much that I think is such a strong organization, and I love it to death. But I decided...
It shows.
I did choose that one of the things I wanted to do in my life is to go back to school and to further myself in on that level, on an academic level, and get a bit more get a bit more to add to my toolbox so that when I come back to doing the animal work directly, as I certainly hope to be doing, I will be even stronger and more able to take on bigger issues.
Well, you certainly are going to be missed, Bruce, and we're so grateful for all that you have done in the last 4 years. I know you will be successful in whatever you do in the future, and we, of course, want to wish you all the luck.
Well, thank you very much, and I'll definitely be right there. I'll be involved in whatever capacity I can as a student.
Thank you.
and you can be absolutely certain that whatever school I end up at, it will become a cage-free school if it isn't already.
Now, Carl has something you want.
Yes, Bruce, we'll love you and we'll miss you desperately. And I have one memory from the chickenout.ca banner which you hold, and it was at the Sun Run. A number of us were holding the chickenout.ca, and Gordon Campbell was running by, and he noticeably looked at the banner.
That's good news.
Well, you know, I think we often forget on how much of an impact we have on all these little things. You know, we hold a banner up, or we wear a T-shirt, or we have a sticker on our binder, or we have a website link at the bottom of our emails. These have such an impact on people around us because we just never know who's looking. So, you know, I think that's a really good example, Carl, and I do thank you so much for all the support that you guys have given us and continue to, and everybody who's listening. We thank you so much, and we'll keep going.
Thank you so much, too, Bruce, for being with us today. You're a wonderful interviewee.
Thanks so much, and happy holidays to everyone.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. Our webpage is animalvoices.org. Our technician, John Pranger, he will post many of our programs on there. And if you'd like to listen to this program again and soak it all in, as we would like you to, to make it more pleasant, John Pranger has some music from Dana Lyons, and Dr. Jane Goodall. Over to John.
Rise. There's a sparkle of hope in every eye. Yes, there's a sparkle of hope in every eye. And when those eyes sparkle at the same time, that's the time when that wave of love will rise.
Yes, and you've been listening to Dana Lyons and singing his prayer for this land. Well, agriculture is what all this is about. The long-distance transport, the production of factory farm animals worldwide. I was reading a report that said that 55 billion animals are slaughtered, are consumed by humans every year. 55 billion. Imagine the bloodshed. Anyway, we do have Kelly Harris in the studio today. Mm-hmm. Nice to see these sparkling eyes and beautiful teeth and clear skin and so complexion. So, yes, you still wanted to say something about...
Well, I really enjoyed that interview with Bruce, and definitely the chicken issue was another thing that I
had no idea about. I had no idea about all these just how the chickens are treated. And after I finished The Omnivore's Dilemma, I went online to do some research, and I came across a website called Wegmans Cruelty, which I definitely urge people to go to, W-E-G-M-A-N-S, wegmanscruelty.com. And on that web page, you can click on the link View Film, and you can watch a kind of a low-resolution, I think it's about a 16-minute film, 20-minute film, where the filmmakers went into a Wegmans, which is a large supermarket in the eastern states, a large chain supermarket. They went into Wegmans' main egg-producing plant because they made all their own eggs to sell at their own stores. And they went in illegally because they weren't allowed access, and they filmed what went on, and they actually rescued 6 chickens that were basically on the verge of death. And I was crying when I watched it. I could not believe it. And even as they're showing us these images, they're playing a voiceover of the PR woman at Wegmans saying, oh no, you know, we take great care of our chickens, and dead chickens in the cages, we wouldn't let that happen. That would be unsanitary, even as the filmmakers are pulling out chickens that have died in the cages. Anyway, they rescue these chickens, and Wegmans tried to sue them for stealing their property, but the jury decided that Wegmans didn't really value these chickens, which were dying in piles of feces underneath all the cages, and so they let them go. But the filmmaker is in jail for, I think, 6 months or something for trespassing. But this film is fabulous, and I urge people to watch it, because it'll make the transition to buying free-range organic eggs very easy. So it's wegmanscruelty.com.
Now, what always intrigues me is that the justice system is so heavily in favor of industry at every levels. And if one watches the shenanigans of what's happening with the what's been happening in Ottawa and Parliament and the Karl-Heinz Schreiber fiasco and lobbying and bribery, and we think, oh, this only happens in third world countries. But hey, this is here happening on a gigantic scale with armaments, mm-hmm. with Airbus purchases for Air Canada, which was at that time was owned by the people of Canada. It was a federal, it was a public company, but it was, you know, like, so... Their influence is such that they have lobbyists there all the time, and there's legislation to curb the power of lobbyists in Ottawa right now, and our present government is saying, wow, we have this legislation intact. But you know what? It's been sitting on the shelf for quite a while and hasn't passed, and they're giving themselves credit for having it on the shelf.
Well, but, and you're right about that. And the frustrating thing about the agricultural industry is that the government has such a hand in it, right? They're subsidizing at all levels. And it's one of the largest industries in our country, and the government definitely profits. So for them to say, okay, you know, we want to slow down things at the slaughterhouse so the cows don't suffer, therefore decrease production, or we want to get all the hens out of cages, therefore bring up the price of eggs. And they're not going to do it. I think the only solution is market demand at the grassroots level. Like you know, we need to get educated and start lifting the curtain that hides what goes on in the agricultural industry and start demanding and start being willing to pay a little bit more initially for the products that are raised ethically and start demanding that that become the main practice.
Now, I have a little story. When Clinton came into power and he chose Al Gore as his running mate, somebody was close to me said she was so excited because she had read his book, which was very environmental. And eventually we heard that people had gone to Al Gore when he was vice president of the United States and said, wow, you know, we were so expectant and hopeful that something really dramatic would happen, something good. And he came back to our people. I don't know who our people are. I won't say who that is. And he said exactly what Kelly, you've said now. He said, when the people are ready, the legislators will act. And you know, we're seeing just this dramatic readiness for people to embrace change rather than say, oh, do I have to give up eating eggs from cruelty factory farms or chickens that have been scalded while they're still alive?
Yeah.
But one question I'd like to just raise here is, what do you think goes into somebody's mind who goes and watches a video on Wegmans cruelty.com and then continues along the path? What kind of justification do you think?
You know, I've asked myself that exact question because, as I said, I only made these changes after Omnivore's Dilemma, and I have read other books. Like, I mean, Diet for a New America by Tom Robbins is the classic tome on the mistreatment of animals in that industry, and I read it probably about 10 years ago. But I don't know. I think a certain amount of information needs to be out there for, you know, and Bruce mentioned this in his interview, for there to be a tipping point, you know, and so at some point, it's no longer, oh, I really shouldn't eat meat. Oh, I really want to, but I guess I won't. It's no longer a hardship. For me, it's there's no question. I mean, I feel repulsed when I look at the meat counter at Safeway. Like, I just can't go there anymore. And so I think, you know, it's a good question, Carl. Like, what does it take to make people change? But I think information and education is really the only way.
My dear friend Diana Jewell said, you know, we put out the message. You have to put the message out 7 times till people actually, it sinks in.
I believe it,
And while you're doing it, she says, you never know when it's the 7th time.
Very, very wise, definitely.
Well, Kelly Harris has decided, we asked her during the break while the song was on, she become a regular contributor to Animal Voices.
I'm thrilled.
So welcome, Kelly Harris.
Thank you.
Thank
yes,
you.
Welcome to the crew.
It's great to be here.
So we like to emphasize on Animal Voices, the more optimistic, and in spite of all what could get us down, and this is a perfect example of it, the optimism is that the Sea Shepherd Society with Captain Paul Watson, they've launched their Operation Migaloo to defend whales in the Antarctic Whale Sanctuary. Well, in this month, the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society will embark on its 4th expedition to the remote southern waters of the coast of Antarctica with the launch of its latest Antarctic Whale Defense Campaign. And that defense campaign is called Migaloo after, I think, a humpback whale in a captivity in a aquarium in Australia. Anyway, the Sea Shepherd Society has drawn a line in the sand when it comes to the humpback whale featured on its logo and will not stand by while the Japanese whalers target nearly 1,000 whales for certain death. They're going to slaughter 1,000 whales.
And it will probably be more, right?
And it's going to include 50 endangered humpback whales and 10 endangered fin whales in the southern oceans. Anyway, that's Captain Paul Watson. He's a hero at the helm. So we only have a few minutes left. John?
2 minutes.
And one of the other thing that's also close to my heart is the recent the Canadian Coalition for Farm Animals has put out an alert for long-distance transport of animals. And, of course, here again, our Canadian regulations are far behind of what it should be. And an example of this is they put out a brochure, and they say, it is legal to transport pigs, horses, and chickens for 36 hours without water, food, or a rest stop. Cows, sheep and goats may legally be without water, food, or rest for 52 hours of transport within Canada. That's absolutely incredible.
It's horrible.
That's more than 2 days and nights. And, of course, it's legal to transport cattle to go 81 hours without food before slaughter, 5 hours before loading. And newly hatched chicks may be transported 72 hours before a stop is required. Well, there's two organizations that highlight this transportation and the long-distance transportation of animals, and it's CETFA.com, CETFA.com, Canadians for the Ethical Treatment of Food Animals, and, of course, the Canadian Coalition for Farm Animals. Canadian Coalition for Farm Animals. So that's on the agenda. And if you have spare time, have a look at Liberation BC. They have they're still doing fur protests outside of the Winners and outside the Aberdeen Centre. That's happening on Sunday, I think. Well, thank you for listening to Animal Voices. Our program is on the webpage, animalvoices.org, and we wish you a happy weekend.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird fly, blackbird fly, into the line of a dark black night. Dark black night.